everyone. You're listening to Deeper Grooves, Musicians on Music, hosted by Cliff Beach and sponsored by California Soul Music Record Label. Today I have the pleasure of speaking with a new friend. His name is John Nado, and he's a guitarist for his band Nado Vision, as well as the rock group Dirty Honey. Very excited to hear him talk about his Nado Vision record. Please help me welcome John Nado.
Hello, John.
Hello.
How are you?
Good. How's it going, man? Thanks for having me.
Oh, man. Excited to have you on the podcast, Deeper Grooves, today. I've been going through all of your stuff over the weekend, and I've heard so much about you from our mutual friends. So I've been listening to Nado Vision for quite a while.
Oh, I appreciate that, man.
Yeah. So very excited to kind of talk about it. So let's chat about the Nado Vision record. What I find interesting about that is you're so entrenched in the rock music scene with Dirty Honey. Why go off and make a funk solo project? Well, what was your approach to this genre of music versus the other rock music?
Oh, it's funny. Well, the simple answer was we hadn't really, Dirty Honey hadn't really taken off yet at the start of that. And I just looked at sort of my voice memo catalog one day and was like, I have a boatload of great funk riffs that I think are actually really good. And I've got a producer engineer who lives at the house. I've got a drummer who lives here. And I knew that the bass player in Dirty Honey is like me, loves funk as well, sort of a secret funk lover. And I just hit everybody up and I was like, do you guys want to help me make this music come to reality? And we just did it. It was a very homegrown project. And then of course I've been friends with Nigel Hall for a long time of Lettuce. And, you know, I was like, can you come play keys on it? It was automatic. Yes. So.
Nice. That's a good friend to have.
Yeah. And I think musically the connection there is, I've always liked funk music a lot, and like coming from the Northeast, you know, the giants out there is like Lettuce and Soul Live and from, you know, 20 years ago and stuff. But before that, all the rock and roll that I always loved, it was always sort of that 70s groovier stuff. And I always saw a kinship between that and funk music. A lot of the riffs are really kind of the same. You know, you just kind of change the emphasis a little, you know. As far as the approach, I think that there's a lot of similarities. You know, a great funk riff really only needs to be, you know, 2 bars, 4 bars long, and you can keep it going. And it's the same with rock and roll. You know, most great rock and roll is the same riff over and over again. You know, and then you hit the chorus, and it's a lot of the same language. It's all blues based. You know, there's just a rhythmic intensity that changes, but it's all related to me, so that was why I did it, I guess, yeah.
Yeah, it sounds like it was a very organic how that shaped up. That's interesting how the bass player is a secret funk lover as well. I think funk definitely has a lot of crossover into rock, so I don't think it's as different as maybe coming from classical to death metal or something.
That would be a little different.
So with Dirty Honey, I mean, you've had explosive success as a guitarist for that group. The single When I'm Gone topped the Billboard mainstream rock song charts. And you guys are the first unsigned band to ever top that chart. And so you also done some stuff with iHeartRadio. You were an On the Verge artist with them. You also were nominated in 2020 as the best new rock band with iHeartRadio. And so you've had millions of streams. How does it feel to be a part of that type of success? I mean, there's so many people that toil in music forever, and you guys have only been doing it relatively a short amount of time.
Yeah.
To be able to have that success kind of almost right off the bat or very, very quickly. How does that feel for you?
It feels as good as you would think, I think. it's exactly what you fantasize about happening. There's a little bit of like disbelief when it's happening at first, at least for me. Not in a, I don't believe this, but as it starts to happen, you go, wait, this is the thing. This is the thing that's happening. It's happening right now. This is, you know, and this is my life. And I think the next response is to quickly work harder, you know, put your head down and try not to get too comfy, you know, because there's, you know, the reality is there's still a long way to go, of course.
Yeah. I mean,
yeah,
you're just in the beginning, but hopefully it just continues the momentum over time.
Yeah. Yeah, totally. We got a lot of heroes to sort of, you know, tap the sword on our shoulders a little bit. You know, we opened for The Who, we opened for the Guns N' Roses, we opened for Slash. Slash had us back many times. He even invited our singer to perform with him at a Gibson Bash. He featured our singer at NAMM, before times, I'm calling it, before COVID.
Yes.
So, you know, there was just all this like sort of magic dust that just happened around it. And even our manager, who, you know, has been in the business for 40 years, I still remember the first gig we played. He was like, this just feels right. There's something different about this, you know? You know, from everything. I mean, we sold, you know, we played this, the first gig we ever played, we played in Phoenix opening for Slash. And now we've never played anywhere, you know? And
that's crazy.
Outside of our town, you know, outside of yeah. LA, you know, outside right. of toiling in obscurity. And, you know, that was part of knowing that we had chosen the right manager because he put that together. And
that's true.
You know, he's there. He came to, you know, oversee everything. And our singer got all the merch together ahead of time. He was really good about being on the ball with that. And so we had T-shirts and we had our logo straight. Our manager was like, you know, don't get your hopes up. You probably sell 5 T-shirts. No one's heard of you. You've never played, you know, just trying to manage our expectations, you know. Mm-hmm, and I remember our merch guy, which was our singer's brother-in-law or brother. And he was like, he comes back. We haven't even played yet. People are just filing into the building. He's like, you guys already sold 5 T-shirts. And we were just like, what? We haven't even played. You know, we didn't even have the EP out, you know, like. We haven't been on the radio, nothing, near zero. And like by the end of the night, we'd sold like $1,000 worth of stuff, pictures and autographs all night, you know, during the whole Slash thing. And one guy even came up and was like, hey, he didn't understand that we didn't work with the Slash merch people. You know, he's just a fan. And he was like, hey, I got this Slash shirt, but I want a Dirty Honey shirt. Can I trade it in? Can I, you know, I think we just gave him one. We were like, yeah, we were so beside ourselves that the guy didn't want a Slash shirt. He wanted our shirt. I just couldn't believe it. So it was an incredible ride that, you know, was just about to be more incredible, honestly, if COVID hadn't happened, but we had quite a year. But the Nato Vision stuff too, man, I have a whole nother album's worth of stuff that, you know, when the time's right and there's a breath, I think that'll come to fruition too, which will be exciting.
Awesome. Awesome. Are you going to do it with the same lineup and work with Brian again?
You know, I have no idea. I'll just try to keep it as organic as I kept it before, you know? I mean, working with him was great because he's really open and really skilled, you know? So I was able to make the album as weird as I wanted it to be, you know, or as not, you know, there was no limits really in that sense. And that's good to have.
I think that's good to just remain open. I mean, the songs will dictate what needs to happen. So just let it organically happen as you did. And I'm sure you'll have another great follow-up to that. And I think that's good. I think that's good to have other outlets, you know, even if Dirty Honey is exploding, just to have other styles. You don't want to necessarily be pigeonholed into one thing, and you have, you know, you have other riffs that may not fit, you know, in a Dirty Honey situation, so you have another toolbox to pull from.
Yeah, and you know, it's just good, like if you just have, you should always just play all the music that you actually really love to play if you can. But you know, succeeding at one thing is incredible.
That is true. So let's talk about your origin story. You're from Massachusetts, but you were raised in Maine. You started playing guitar around 8. I'm thinking you grew up on Hendrix and Queen and Van Halen, AC/DC, Led Zeppelin, Allman Brothers, Guns N' Roses, Jeff Buckley. But then you had some of the funk and soul and R&B from people like Stevie Wonder. You studied music at the University of Southern Maine.
Yeah.
So how did you end up on the West Coast?
You know, it was actually a girl.
That makes sense. That's usually the way.
It's usually the way, right? you know, after college, it was just like what to do. And we that, you know, had this thing with a girl, and she got like a pretty big break out here that later didn't really turn into anything, but at the time seemed pretty. And I just started exploring out here. And then I found out that I met people that I knew through, you know, like friends of friends and things, and they were able to link me up. So I just saw an opportunity to be in a place. My first lure was I really saw the work that she got. And then I saw when I came out here, I was like, wow, like the rock and roll thing is still kind of alive out here in somewhat of a cheesy 80s way, which isn't my style, but you know, with all the leather and the Mohawks and that shit, but the Motley Crue thing, but
exactly.
But nonetheless, I was still like, it's out here. Like, and that it really isn't out there in the Northeast. It's more like jam band rock, which I also love, but I don't love all of it. I think that kind of sparked me. I just was like, this would be a nice, it just seemed exciting to me. And so I just said, to hell with it. Just jump off a cliff, see what happens. I'm not with that girl anymore, but.
Well, you got more groupies now.
Right. Yeah, that's really as simple as it was. I just kind of, again, just like, just had an open mind and was just kind of like, you know, down to wing it. It, you know, things weren't immediate, but I met Mark, the singer, fairly early on. And, you know, we just built this thing slowly through playing covers at bars. All the while I was doing whatever I had to do as just a guitarist for hire was kind of my approach, you know.
It sounds like you hit the ground running pretty quickly right after school, basically, and following this girl and now following your musical path. So with your origins, you started on a red and white Stratocaster, and that's made by Epiphone. And then, but your prized possessions are listed as a 58 reissue of Gibson Les Paul and a 1930s Dobro that you purchased from some money you inherited from your grandfather. So what acts do you play now? What are you shredding and melting faces on and Dirty Honey and Not a Vision?
Still, the 58 reissue is, that's just got a special sound and place and feel under my hands. Like, and I switch pickups in it all the time, and it, whatever you put in it, it's always a good version of that. It's just, or a great, you know, there's just something about that piece of wood. But since Dirty Honey started to get radio success, I was able to establish a relationship with Gibson. So I have two brand new standards from them, Gibson Les Paul standards. And I also have a J45 acoustic. Those are really kind of the guitars I play now. Being now that the focus has been 100% Dirty Honey, like writing riffs, trying to, you know, continue this thing and like nurture it. The sound for me and that I just go back to is the Les Paul and the Marshall. So when we got with Gibson, it was like, you know, I don't need an SG. I don't need, you know, I don't need a semi-hollow. So, you know, which is funny, you know, because of course with like the Not a Vision stuff, it was very much okay. Cause that's really just a studio project. So it was very much like whatever sounds right for what the moment in the song's calling for. So there's a kind of a myriad of guitars on that record. But Dirty Honey is almost exclusively, well, actually, you know what? It's a combination of Gibsons, actually. That is kind of my secret. The more I talk about it, when I get into the studio, I kind of reach for whatever might be right, you know? I don't necessarily go, this is my guitar. But live, I really only want the Gibson Les Paul in my hand.
Oh, yeah. And Gibson, if you're listening to this podcast, I'm sure they'd love to hear it. I think I've heard in the studio and live, like a part of the sound is kind of having, I don't know what it is, but like dirty strings. Like you're not supposed to change your strings because they're too clean, too tight in the recording process. Is that true?
No, not really. I mean, there's just kind of if you got the brand new strings, you get the most sparkle and jangly period of the string is that first play. But there's a nice sweet spot right after that when they've been played a little bit and that part wears off. But generally the thing I find with old strings is they don't intonate as well anymore. So you really do got to change them. That's more of a bass thing to keep old strings on.
Yeah, maybe that is what I'm thinking.
Yeah.
More bass players.
It's funny, too, because our bass player doesn't like to do that. He's one of the few bass players I know who doesn't, because he's heavily influenced by, like, the Rage Against... I mean, he loves all the Motown stuff and all the groove stuff, which those would be the guys who would play, like, you know, 80-year-old strings that are, like, flat wound and nice and dead. But he likes a brighter sound, and he likes to mix. You know, ideally, if we had, you know, the money and the and the stagehands, he would have a half stack and a bass amp, you know, and have a distortion signal mixed in, you know. So if he kind of likes it, he kind of likes new strings. One of the few bass players I know does that. A lot of guys, yeah, they like to just. They just like to ride it until Armageddon gets here. I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, everyone has, like, their own approach for different reasons. But, yeah, it's just interesting to get into the weeds, obviously, at NAMM and those types of shows. It's like guitar center on steroids. Just so many people playing guitar and checking out all the latest and greatest from all the companies.
It's so cool. It's literally – when I first went, I was, like, amazing. But I think that was the only time it was amazing.
Yeah, it's difficult to do.
It's difficult to do. The next time it was amazing was like the second or third time when I actually had a tour that I could actually, and I had some guys, some other side men help me out and gave my name to people. So I was able to go get some stuff. But other than that, you know, it's a massive guitar center.
Yes.
And pretty, pretty fun if you hit the beer tent.
That's true. You got to keep that energy flowing and stay hydrated. Stay hydrated. And so you've also been written about in Guitar World and Vintage Guitar magazines. And that's a very high honor for a guitarist. So what were kind of like the guitar magazines that you flocked to when you were kind of coming up?
You know, I didn't really have a lot of subscriptions as a kid. We didn't really have the extra money for that. I know it's not much, but I just didn't have those. But later on, it was really any guitar magazine, Guitar World, Guitar Player, you know, those are kind of on the same shelf to me as each other. And yeah, I mean, it was just an incredible honor just to be in there. And that's, the guy did a great interview too. Yeah, I definitely have like 5 copies of that. So,
as you should. And we didn't have subscriptions growing up to that stuff, but I would always, if I walked by like a newsstand, I would pick up like a Rolling Stone and look to see what was saying. The reviews and stuff.
Yeah, I was always upset. I always thought Rolling Stone was cool, and I'd try to get old ones too, you know, try to find old ones online and stuff.
Oh, yeah, I love all that kind of stuff. I actually somehow stumbled upon like a Lifetime subscription. It's not really Lifetime, but 50 years of Rolling Stone. So I've been getting it since, I don't even want to say when, but like the early 2000s. And I'm still getting it, I think, until like 2040 something.
Yeah. Oh, that's so cool, though. Yeah, I mean, that's, you know, it's like the internet's around, but it's not like what it is today, you know?
Oh, yeah, no, it always changed. I mean, you see like an old... like John Lennon on the cover, and you're like, man, I think they were like hand painted or drawn or something.
I'm just like, so happy that it was Hendrix on the cover that on the issue I did. That I was just I was just like, you know, that doesn't have anything to do with me, but I just sort of luck of the draw. But I just thought for my first one, I'm so pumped about that.
Yeah, there's pretty much, I mean, Hendrix is definitely top, if not number one, definitely top 5 for sure.
I think in the rock world, he's I don't know if there's any bigger, more important moment than what he did with electric guitar. That's really like there's like a pre-Hendrix guitar life world and a post-Hendrix, in my opinion. That's not to take anything away from anyone else. It's just, what he did sonically and with the whammy bar and with the way he improvised, it's just such a high watermark for guitar. And everyone else just took that and ran with it, you know, and did their own versions of it. You know, I mean, before that, I think it's Chuck Berry, but we hadn't hit that sonic thing yet. And when he did that, just lights out. I mean, If forever people were like, he always gets the number one slot, totally deserved. You know, I think you have to make a strong argument to put someone above him as a more important guitarist.
Oh yeah. And I think there are guitarists that are very humble. I mean, you talk to someone like an Eric Clapton and they say, how do you feel about being the best guitarist? And he says, I don't know. You have to ask Prince. So I think if someone like that is humbled by other people's musicianship, then I think they would often be humbled by Jimmy too.
Yeah. Yeah. Prince. Yeah. Prince is so, he's unbelievable too, man. He's unbelievable. He's better than most. Prince gets shafted. He's better than most people who probably get put above him. But that's purely because I think guitarists in the guitar world, they don't notice him because he's dance music. Yeah, what he does, just ridiculous.
Oh, yeah. You watch him with Petty and the rest of them on the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame induction when he does While My Guitar Gently Weeps, that solo, everyone's just looks like they're in awe.
They are. He has that Hendrix performance factor where it's more than just a guy standing there good at guitar or even great. And then he has the sound. He has the explosiveness. He has that like freeness with it. He has the virtuosity. And then he's also one of the best funk guitar players that ever existed. Like when he turns all that Hendrix tone off and plays rhythm guitar, it's second to none. I don't even know if people even notice that because that's tucked in the music, but he's playing all that stuff.
Yeah. Oh yeah. I mean, he plays everything and you'll see concerts where he switches from guitar to bass to piano and he's playing the drums and he's dancing. It's a lot. For someone that has so much talent, a concentrated compact talent in a 5-2 frame. Exactly. So then what advice would you give like a newbie starting out, like someone just playing guitar at home or playing with their friends like in middle school or high school? Like what advice would you give someone that may be thinking about moving to LA and starting a career?
I would say if you're still in junior high or high school, your number one goal is to be as good as you possibly can. And that doesn't mean be good at everything. You don't have to be the guy who's, because there's a lot of that where people are like, oh, I got to get my country licks together. Oh, I got to get my, I better get my shred chops together. Oh, I better get my funk chops together. You know, yes, I have a funk album and I've played on other people's funk stuff, but I just love that, you know. So just follow what you love and only compare yourself to the greats. And record yourself and then listen to yourself and figure out what sucks about it and fix it, because you have the time. You're in high school. You don't have bills. you don't have really too much to worry about that you will later. And when that other stuff comes, you want to be so damn good, and you want to be good at a thing. It's so funny, when we were playing in the before times, we were getting a lot of those questions from young teens who would be at the show, like 13-year-olds, their dad would be with them and they'd be like, yeah, my son plays, my daughter plays, like what advice? And I'd just be like, just be as dope as you can right now. That's your only mission. That's your only mission. You know, if you got a city, if you got your, you know, like if you have your, obviously if you have your eyes set on LA or Nashville, you know, just learn about that city, you know, of course, you know, showing up with a clue, of course, is always a good thing. Because sometimes kids will ask me like, well, the dad will be like, you know, how important is management and how important is blah, 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 and this and that, you know, I'm like, well, listen, if you're not amazing, none of it matters, you know, and if you're 13, just focus on that. Just focus on that. You want to be a great songwriter? Write songs all the time. You know, you want to be a great lead guitar player? You know, learn from your heroes. You know, keep love as part of the equation.
Oh, yeah. We definitely need love. And that's why we come back to it and do it, because we love it. You would do it for free because you love it so much.
and keep chasing the thing, the styles that you love. Don't worry about the other stuff, you know? Because that's one thing that I feel like I didn't like about institutionalized musical education was, well, it's really that liberal arts approach where they're like, well, you should be good at everything. I really didn't like that. I really didn't think that made sense. It just, it's an approach to like getting you to be able to get a lot of work. We're like, well, you can play all kinds of stuff, but you'll never be an expert at any of it. And so I think that you should follow only what gives you the goosebumps.
Yeah, no, I definitely agree with that. I think in the same way with liberal arts, like people are like, okay, you're weak in this area, you should work on that. I'm like, hell no, you should work on your strength. You don't have time to work on your weakness. Find someone else that's good at what you're weak at. They can do that. If you're not into numbers or something, just let someone else do that. Delegate that to someone else. Focus on what you're passionate about and what really moves the needle for you. Because really, you can only do like two or three things. Once you pass that mark, you're not really doing anything. You just become, you know, so
hell yeah,
scattered.
Amen. I mean, that's 100% what it is. And there was this pivotal moment when I was in college, and I remember we were sort of combating a teacher a little bit, and he was trying to hit us with that philosophy. It was like, you know, in between class, he's like, you know, you want to be able to have your Latin chops, you want to be able to have your funk chops, you want to be able to, he's like, and he looks at me, he's like, if you're only good at R&B guitar, or he was like, if you're the best R&B guitarist, you'll only get the R&B gigs. And this other student goes, yeah, but he'll be the best R&B guitarist. And I was like, yeah, like this industry, fuck, I hate saying that. Being the best at something is what's interesting, you know, or being amongst the corral of the greats, you know, that's the goal. And to your point, you really got to focus on a smaller area to get there. You know, our singer, man, he's the best rock singer I've ever heard our age, you know, who's not an older guy. And he's never been interested in singing backup harmonies. He's never been interested in learning how to do it. He's never been interested in trying to add R&B stuff. He's just like, I'm a rock and roll singer. I'm a lead singer. And he just perfects that craft, you know? So that's why there's nobody as good as him.
No, I get it. I get it. I mean, you think of someone, an amazing guitarist like B.B. King. B.B. King's playing with U2. And U2's like, okay, yeah, these are the chords for that song. He's like, I don't play chords. He's like, I just solo.
I don't play chords. That's so great. I don't even think that's so funny. That's taking it further than I'm even talking. And I love it. I love it.
Yeah. So no, I get it. I get it. Like, I'm just gonna solo. That's what you're gonna get. You know,
that's so good. I don't play chords. Okay, okay, BB King, whatever you say.
Exactly. So, to finalize this, what do you want your legacy to be? I know you've only been out a few years, but if you only had a few years, looking like a Jimi Hendrix, he died so early at 27, in that club of people. What would you want to be most remembered for musically?
Oh man, I'd want to be remembered for being great. I think what we were building was that what we're doing was real and that people felt it, you know, both in the guitar playing and just being part of something that, like the band, being part of something that gave the people something real, you know, and I think that sets us apart from, you know, everything else that's going on. You know, there's so much canned and in the box stuff. You know, if I could innovate something, that'd be cool. Yeah, I want to be remembered as something where the feeling of it is the strongest nerve of it, you know, because I think that lasts forever.
Oh yeah, I mean, Maya Angelou says like they won't remember what you said or did, but they'll remember how you made them feel. You can make people feel something. Really, music and working with an audience is a transference of feeling. You're feeling a certain way about the song that's pushing out to the audience. They're feeling a certain way, it's pushing back to you in this constant feedback loop.
I love that. Who said that?
Maya Angelou.
Oh yeah. Yeah. And she's awesome. Yeah. So that's great. Yeah.
Awesome. So we thank you so much for being on the podcast today and talking just a little bit about your history. I'm sure we could go all day on it, but what's next for the band and what's next for Nautavision? I know you said that you have another album of Nautavision that you could work on at some point. I hope that you do. I'd love to hear it. And if you guys ever have vocals, we'd always love to collab, but we have a funk band and stuff. But I know that the band, right before COVID, you were about to go to Australia and record kind of a follow-up release later this year. And those plans have been kind of on hold. But you were doing some writing with your Australian-based producer, Nick Dadia, online via Skype. So do you think remotely you guys will kind of work on some stuff and finish some stuff? Or like, what's kind of next?
That's the goal, is to try and just push it along as any way we can. You know, it's just the trouble with what's happening is honestly scheduling things, man. Because, you know, we're looking at getting into a major studio, and, you know, with Nick, what comes with Nick is long-standing relationships with a lot of them in LA and stuff from his career. I mean, it's just, you know, studios are working at, they're not allowing people, they're not filling up the rooms, you know, because of the COVID precautions. So they just got a lot less capacity. So I don't know where we are in line, you know, but we're just working on our music and tweaking the songs and trying to come up with new ones. We've definitely got an EP's worth of songs that we feel are as strong as the others, as what we've released. And we've probably got a full album's worth if we were to go that route, you know. Our camp likes the EP size, because they, where there's no pressure to fill up two sides of a tape or a record anymore, or a CD, there's a lot of feeling of like, well, if we have six great songs and then four other pretty good ones, they're like, let's just put out the six great ones and we'll just do another EP. So whereas, you know, in the yester decades, you'd put out 10 or 12 and you'd have, you know, the filler, as it were. There's no need for filler anymore. So I think we have a strong EP. You know, we probably have a really good full record. Who knows what it'll look like, you know, what that game time decision will be. But yeah, I mean, we're just trying to do anything we can to push that ball forward, given the circumstances.
Oh, yeah. Well, I'm sure you guys will figure it out, or enough time will pass, and hopefully we'll have some better news towards the end of the year about what 2021 will be looking like.
Yeah.
But until then, I mean, everyone is still staying active, writing and keeping up the chops and things like that.
Absolutely. Yeah. No, it's the bass player and the drummer were here yesterday. We jammed, you know, just keeping the connection alive and keeping things fresh and just staying loose, you know.
Yeah, well, we look forward to definitely keeping in touch with you guys as your career continues to grow. We'll circle back to you and your team once the links and everything for this is done, so that we can push it out and people can hear your interview, because I think people really should kind of hear what you have to say. And I think whether you've been in the business for a few years or a long, long time, I think everyone has nuggets of truth and their truth that they stand in every day and operate from. And I think that people need to hear that. I think everyone has a story and they should be able to share it.
Well, that's great that you have that point of view. So you're doing the right thing by doing this, because that's right on, man.
Also, John, well, thank you for being on Deeper Grooves today. We'll circle back to you in a little while when it's all done. And we'll be talking to you soon.
All right. Thanks, Cliff.
Take care. Have a good one.
Cheers.
Bye-bye. You've just tuned in to Deeper Grooves, Musicians on Music, hosted by Cliff Beach and sponsored by California Soul Music Record Label. I had such a good time today talking with John Nato from Dirty Honey and about his group, Nato Vision. Really cool funk, definitely check that out. Stream it everywhere. Awesome rock, stream it everywhere on Spotify. It's amazing. Dirty Honey, Nato Vision. Check them out. I'd also like to thank our engineer, Tim Hall and 1192 Studios, for mixing and mastering this recording today. If you like what you hear and you want to hear more, you can check us out online at www.californiasoulmusic.com/deepergroove. Until then, keep it rocking. I'll talk to you soon. Bye.